Welcome to What Happened to Me, Part 1, by Randall Niles. For all the footnotes, resources, and other materials, please go to www.allaboutthejourney.org. You know, my biggest barrier to any kind of religious faith was 20th century science and technology. To me, supernatural faith was merely a product of simple ancient peoples trying to explain the world around them. You know, the sun, the moon, and the stars, seasonal crop cycles, human reproduction, etc. Well, those ancient days are gone. We now understand the world around us. We've mapped the cosmos. We've mastered agrarian techniques, and we've deciphered the human genome. So in a nutshell, 20th century advances in science and technology removed the need for God, any kind of a God. More specifically, here's exactly what I believed. All things from the massive cosmos to the microscopic cell are the result of unguided natural processes over millions and billions of years. Everything is explained by the physical, so therefore there's no need for any notion of the metaphysical. Everything is the result of wonderful chance, held together by chemical-based systems, natural laws, and properties of physics. Smart people with telescopes and microscopes broke the code once and for all using 20th century technology. The facts of science trump anything philosophical or religious. Done. You know, maybe the introduction to the Emmy Award-winning PBS Nova special called The Miracle of Life summed up my views best. Quote, 4.5 billion years ago, the young planet Earth was a mass of cosmic dust and particles. It was almost completely engulfed by the shallow primordial seas. Powerful winds gathered random molecules from the atmosphere, and some were deposited in the seas. Tides and currents swept the molecules together, and somewhere in this ancient ocean, the miracle of life began. The first organized form of primitive life was a tiny protozoan. Millions of protozoa populated the ancient seas. These early organisms were completely self-sufficient in their seawater world. They moved about their aquatic environment, feeding on bacteria and other organisms, and from these one-celled organisms evolved all life on Earth. Well, sometimes it takes a simple thought to shake the foundations of an entire thought system. It was during a youth sports camp in late 1999 with my kids that I had this effortless epiphany. It was, make sure your kids drink plenty of water, we were told. Hydration, 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 that's the key. Well, no problem, I thought. Everyone knows this basic principle of nutritional science. And then it hit me. Hey, when I was a kid playing sports, water was treated merely as a reward. I mean, even if we got a moment at the drinking fountain, the coaches would monitor our time, so we didn't drink too much. You'll get a stitch in your side, they said. In fact, at halftime, we only got orange slices because fluids would cramp us up and slow us down. And then I remembered my father's experience with sports as a kid. And during his generation, athletes actually took salt tablets, sometimes in large amounts. I mean, coaches actually viewed hydration during games as taboo. So then, you know, kazip, or whatever that sound is when the shutter clicks on a camera. You know, I had one of those picture moment experiences where a truth comes into focus and sticks with you forever. Science isn't static. Science changes over time. I mean, the observable evidence doesn't change, but the scientific understanding of that evidence does. So in my straightforward illustration, these three generations of athletes face three different views of nutritional science. The observable evidence regarding water and the human body didn't change, but the scientific presentation, and especially the public perception of that evidence, advanced at least three times over a few decades. For some reason, this simple thought really challenged me. I mean, for some reason, this really inconsequential moment in my life opened a floodgate of far-reaching questions. I needed to look at the observable evidence again, and it was time to start examining my decades old presuppositions about science and nature and technology. I decided to go back to the big picture basics of the world around me, and I started to read and study again. So here's what I discovered. First, I went to look at how the scientists are currently explaining the origin of the universe. And it seems that the Big Bang Theory and its related inflation universe theories, the IUTs, are still today's dominant scientific conjectures about the origin of the universe. And according to these interrelated notions, the universe was created between 13 and 20 billion years ago from the random cosmic explosion or expansion of this little subatomic ball that hurled space, time, matter, and energy in all directions. I mean, everything, the whole universe, came from an initial speck of infinite density, also known as a singularity. And this speck, existing outside of space and time, appeared from nowhere, for no reason, only to explode all of a sudden. And over a period of approximately 10 billion years, this newly created space, time, matter, and energy evolved into remarkably designed and fully functional stars, galaxies, and planets, including our Earth. That sounds familiar. So I'll move on. So then I looked at how do scientists currently explain the origin of life. And generally, evolutionary theory is still the foundation of today's scientific worldview. By and large, the textbooks teach that organic life sprung from non-organic matter exclusively through a natural mechanistic process on a prebiotic Earth. And that original life form then evolved into more complex life forms through a natural process of random mutations and natural selection. In a nutshell, the major scientific hypothesis is that matter, randomly acting on matter, for a long period of time, created everything we see. And that's pretty much what I remember, so there's really no change there. Wait! My skeptical mind, man, it just started churning. How can nothing explode? Where did all that matter and energy come from? What caused its release? How did this explosion of everything from nothing order itself? How can simplicity become complexity? Where did the chemical elements come from? Where did the mathematical laws and physical properties come from? How do we explain the design, complexity, and fine-tuning inherent in spiral galaxies, solar systems, and stars? How did life come from a rock? How did a bird come from a lizard? Why don't we see birds come from lizards today? Why are there no transitional fossils in our museums today? Why have we never observed beneficial mutations? Where did the information code in DNA come from? Where did the language convention that interprets DNA come from? How can we explain the random development of the human eye, reproductive system, digestive tract, the brain, heart, lungs? What about the subconscious mind? What about love, morality, ethics, and emotions? Can these things really evolve gradually and randomly over time? I mean, jeepers, what was happening to me? I mean, literally, I was in a state of stream of consciousness skepticism. Everything I knew and thought I knew about the world around me didn't make sense anymore. I couldn't go back. If I was going to be intellectually honest with myself, I couldn't retreat to my prior way of thinking. I had to go forward and personally look at the observable evidence. But where to begin? Well, by chance, a coworker had collected a few of today's high school biology textbooks. And I opened one of them on a lark, and I was really stunned by the first page I saw. There was that same evolutionary chart of species that I remembered from the wall of my high school classroom. It was like a tree-like graphic with a bunch of simple life forms at the bottom and a series of more complex creatures toward the top. And I always thought that this was a reasonable presentation. But now my skeptical mind was whirring. And regardless of any theoretical problems with the tree itself, what about all the evolutionary processes required to get to the first simple life forms at the bottom of the chart in the first place? So how does the theory of evolution really work? The evolution tree in my high school classroom only dealt with the macroevolutionary chain between organic creatures. And through my quick study, I found at least five other fundamental stages of evolution that would be required prior to any possibility of organic life. In fact, each stage seemed essential to the next in the overall theory. The first is cosmic evolution. The idea that space, time, matter, and energy somehow exploded or expanded from essentially nothing in the sudden Big Bang that was the birth of our universe. And the second stage is stellar evolution. And since the Big Bang is thought to have produced only hydrogen, helium, and a variety of subatomic particles, these elements must have somehow condensed into stars through some sort of evolutionary process. And then the third stage is chemical evolution. And according to general thought, the only chemical elements produced by the Big Bang were hydrogen and helium, and possibly lithium. And as a result of the incredible heat and pressure within stars, these original elements somehow evolved into the other 88 naturally occurring chemical elements we observe today. So then you have the fourth stage, which is planetary evolution. The complex chemical elements thought to have evolved within ancient stars were somehow ejected, possibly at the violent deaths of stellar life cycles, releasing these great clouds of swirling compounds. And these clouds of chemical elements somehow formed finely tuned solar systems, including our own. Then you have the fifth phase, which is organic evolution, also known as spontaneous generation. The theory is that the planet Earth began as a molten mass of matter a few billion years ago, and then it cooled off into solid dry rock, and then it rained on the rocks for millions of years, forming great oceans. And eventually this prebiotic rock soup, water and rock, came alive and spawned the first self-replicating organic systems. Okay, now I have more questions than ever, but at least I made it to the base of the so-called evolution tree. And this is where the sixth phase of general evolutionary theory occurs, and this is macroevolution. All living creatures are thought to share a common ancestor, a relatively simple single-celled organism, which evolved from inorganic matter, so-called rock soup. Essentially, the birds and the bananas, the fishes and the flowers are all genetically related. Oh, we need to add one more, the seventh and final stage of the theory, which is microevolution. And microevolution is the variation and variety of traits expressed in sexually compatible kinds of organisms. Examples include the differences between various kinds of horses, dogs, cats, etc. This variation within a kind is what Darwin observed in the mid-1800s and what we still observe today. Okay, so let's recap. Evolutionary theory appears to have seven distinct interrelated phases set by science in the following order. Cosmic evolution, which is the development of space, time, matter, and energy from nothing. Stellar evolution, which is the development of complex stars from the chaotic first elements. Chemical evolution, which is the development of all chemical elements from an original two. Planetary evolution, which is the development of planetary systems from swirling elements. Organic evolution, which is the development of organic life from inorganic matter, a rock. Macroevolution, the development of one kind of life from a totally different kind of life. And then microevolution, which is the development of variations within the same kind of life. You know, interestingly, the science books and the television documentaries declare that only the seventh phase, microevolution, has been observed and documented. The first six phases of evolution are merely assumed. But that's okay. Isn't it logical to use microevolutionary observations to connect the dots on all the other required phases of evolution? Wait, where did this come from in the first place? I mean, did this really all start with Darwin? Is this all in Darwin's book? Did I even read that book? I mean, it seems everyone remembers reading Darwin's Origin of Species, but how many of us have really read it? Darwinian evolution was presented as such an established fact in my high school biology class, I guess that there wasn't any reason to go back and read the original theoretical treatise. Well, that was then, and this is now. I decided to read Darwin's book for myself. Charles Darwin and His Origin of Species. In 1831, Charles Darwin sailed as a passenger on the HMS Beagle, and his five-year voyage took him to the coasts of South America, where he observed various kinds of animals, and one set of creatures in particular, the Galapagos finches, caught Darwin's attention. He studied the birds, he collected samples, and observed that they had various beak sizes and shapes. These observed variations inspired the initial development of Darwin's theory of origins, and he returned to England in 1836. In 1842, Darwin began drafting on the origin of species by means of natural selection or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life, often referred simply to Origin of Species. His work was heavily influenced by Sir Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, 1830, and Thomas Malthus's An Essay on Principles of Population, 1798. Origin of Species was ultimately published in 1859. Guess what? I like Darwin's book. I mean, in a nutshell, Origin of Species proposes natural selection as the mechanism by which an original simple-celled organism could have evolved gradually into all species we observe today, both plant and animal. Generally, Darwin presents a theory of evolution, which he defines as descent with modification. It's actually a fun read and a compelling hypothesis for the time. However, 100 years later, scientists realized that Darwin's basic theory needed work. Natural selection is a conservative process, not a means of developing complexity from simplicity. And as scientists started understanding the nature of genetics, they were forced to update Darwin's original theory. And they proposed that natural selection in conjunction with genetic mutation allowed for the development of all species from a common ancestor. Although true beneficial mutations have never been observed, scientists only observe harmful downward mutations, this is today's general conjecture regarding evolutionary change. But what about the common ancestor at the bottom of the evolutionary tree? Well, this is where we look at this so-called spontaneous generation and the first life form. Darwinian and neo-Darwinian evolution only focus on the mechanism for modification over time between kinds of organisms. Evolutionary theory still doesn't deal with the first organism that arose by chance on our so-called primitive planet. This is called spontaneous generation. And without outside input, spontaneous generation is really the only explanation for the first organisms on Earth. This concept goes way back to Anaximander, a Greek philosopher in the 6th century BC, who proposed that life arose from mud when exposed to sunlight. And although Darwin's theory focused on the mechanism for evolutionary change between life forms, he also maintained that original life probably arose from a, quote, little pond where sunlight was acting on organic salts. In the 1920s, scientists Oparin and Haldane updated the basic conjecture of spontaneous generation by proclaiming that ultraviolet light acting on a primitive atmosphere of water, ammonia, and methane produced a, quote, hot dilute soup of basic life. As I continued my reading, I discovered an interesting theme. The general public and educational media seem fine with these basic theories and conjectures. However, over the last couple decades, the scientific community has grown increasingly uneasy. Whereas 20th century science and technology somehow removed the philosophical need for anything metaphysical, 21st century science and technology were revealing things that can't be explained through merely assumed physical processes. Quote, considering the way the prebiotic soup is referred to in so many discussions of the origin of life as an already established reality, it comes as something of a shock to realize that there is absolutely no positive evidence for its existence, end quote. Something wasn't connecting here. Scientists across the board, whether atheist, agnostic, or theist, were declaring that spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago. In fact, evolutionary scientists themselves started looking at the odds that a free, living, single-celled organism, a bacterium for example, could result from a chance combining of life building blocks, amino acids for example. Harold Morowitz, a renowned physicist from Yale University and author of Origin of Cellular Life in 1993, declared that the odds for any kind of spontaneous generation were one chance in 10 to the 100th trillionth power. That's 10 to a 1 with a lot of zeros after it. Sir Fred Hoyle, a popular agnostic who wrote Evolution from Space in 1981, proposed that such odds were 1 chance in 10 to the 40,000th power. That's the same as the probability that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard could assemble a fully functional 747. Francis Crick, an atheist and co-discoverer of the DNA structure in 1953, calls life, quote, almost a miracle. He couldn't rationalize the metaphysical implications of his DNA discovery, so he devised his interstellar spores theory in the 1970s. By the way, scientists from various disciplines generally set their impossibility standard at 1 chance in 10 to the 50th power. Therefore, looking at the odds proposed by Morowitz, Hoyle, Crick, were way beyond the impossibility standard. Therefore, the notion that life somehow rose from non-life has clearly met the scientific standard for statistical impossibility. I think Harvard University biochemist and Nobel laureate George Wald shed perfect light on the whole situation when he declared, quote, "One has to only contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet we are here as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation," end quote. So what are these scientists discovering? I mean, why are they declaring such huge odds against their own theories? Why are they proposing new and slightly outlandish conjectures about DNA spores from alien cultures? Well, let's take a look. The DNA molecule is one of the greatest scientific discoveries of all time. I mean, first described by James Watson and Francis Crick in 1953, DNA is that famous storehouse of genetics that establishes each organism's physical characteristics. It wasn't until mid-2001 that the Human Genome Project and Celera Genomics jointly presented the first true nature and complexity of the digital code inherent in DNA. That each human DNA molecule is comprised of chemical bases arranged in approximately 3 billion precise sequences. I mean, even the DNA molecule for the single-celled bacterium E. coli contains enough information to fill an entire set of Encyclopedia Britannica. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is a double-stranded molecule that's twisted into a helix like a spiral staircase, and each strand is comprised of a sugar phosphate backbone and numerous base chemicals attached in pairs. The four bases that make up the stairs in the spiraling staircase are adenine, which is represented by an A, thymine, which is represented by a T, cytosine, which is represented by a C, and guanine, which is represented by a G. And these stairs act as the letters in the genetic alphabet, combining into complex sequences to form the words, sentences, and paragraphs that act as instructions to guide the formation and functioning of the host cell. Maybe even more appropriately, the A, T, C, and G in the genetic code of the DNA molecule can be compared to the 0 and 1 in the binary code of computer software. Like software to a computer, the DNA code is a genetic language that communicates information to the organic cell. The DNA code, like a floppy disk of binary code, is quite simple in its basic paired structure. However, it's the sequencing and functioning of that code that's enormously complex. Through recent technologies like X-ray crystallography, we now know that the cell is not a blob of protoplasm, but rather a microscopic marvel that is more complex than the space shuttle. I mean, the cell is very complicated, using vast numbers of phenomenally precise DNA instructions to control its every function. And although DNA code is remarkably complex, it's the information translation system connected to that code that really baffles science. I mean, like any other language, the letters and words mean nothing outside the language convention used to give those letters and words meaning. This is modern information theory at its core. A simple binary example of information theory would be the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. And in that famous story, Mr. Revere asks a friend to put one light in the window of the North Church if the British come by land, and two lights if they came by sea. Well, without a shared language convention between Paul Revere and his friend, that simple communication effort would mean nothing. Well, take that simple example and multiply by a factor containing hundreds of zeros. DNA molecule is an intricate message system. To claim that DNA arose randomly is to say that information can develop randomly. Many scientists argue that the chemical building blocks of the DNA molecule can be explained by natural material processes over millions of years. However, explaining the material base of a message is completely independent of the information transmitted using those materials. Thus, the chemical building blocks have nothing to do with the origin of the complex message itself. As a simple illustration, the information content of the clause, quote, "nature and design," has nothing to do with the writing material used, whether ink, paint, chalk, or crayon. In fact, the clause could be written in binary code, Morse code, or smoke signals, but the message remains the same, independent of the medium. There's obviously no relationship between the information and the material base used to transmit it. Some current theories argue that self-organizing properties within the base chemicals themselves created the information in the first DNA molecule. And others argue that external self-organizing forces created the first DNA molecule. However, these theories must hold to the illogical conclusion that the material used to transmit the information also produced the information itself. And although I'm not a scientist, logic tells me that the information contained within the genetic code must be entirely independent of the chemical makeup of the DNA molecule. I mean, does this science stuff make any sense? Am I correctly interpreting the awesome complexity of the DNA molecule that we only recently started to understand? It seems to me that anyone who goes out and truly investigates the miracle of the DNA molecule, I mean, this incredible micro, digital, error-correcting, redundant, self-duplicating information storage and retrieval system with its own inherent language convention that has the potential to develop any organism from raw biological material, has to be equally awestruck. Quote, "It is astonishing to think that this remarkable piece of machinery, which possesses the ultimate capacity to construct every living thing that ever existed on Earth, from the giant redwood to the human brain, can construct all its own components in a matter of minutes and weigh less than 10 to the negative 16 grams. It is of the order of several thousand million million times smaller than the smallest piece of functional machinery ever constructed by man." End quote, Michael Denton. I mean, with the discovery, mapping, and sequencing of the DNA molecule over the last few decades, we now understand that organic life is based on vastly complex information code. And like today's most complex software codes, such information cannot be created or interpreted without some kind of intelligence. I mean, for me, truly understanding the scientific reality of the DNA molecule single-handedly defeated my lifelong presupposition that life arose from non-life through random materialistic forces. I mean, even with trillions of years, the development of DNA is statistically impossible. But hey, let's dig in further. If DNA is the information storehouse that acts as the blueprint for cellular development, what do these functional cells look like? Are they really all that complex? So that's the end of What Happened to Me, Part 1 by Randall Niles. For further information, resources, footnotes, go to www.allaboutthejourney.org, and please listen to Part 2 in What Happened to Me by Randall Niles.